Hello and welcome to the London Philharmonic Orchestra's October podcast. I'm Edward Seckerson, and joining me this month are the conductor and soloist of one of the month's concert highlights, as well as news of the latest CD release from the orchestra's archive. Don't forget you can find out more information and buy tickets and CDs from our website, www.lpo.org.uk. Well, the focus of this month's podcast is the concert at the Royal Festival Hall on the 24th of October. It's the first of four concerts this season with Yannick Nézet-Séguin, the orchestra's dynamic young principal guest conductor. And it pairs Bruckner's mighty Eighth Symphony with the world premiere of a percussion concerto by Rautavaara. I'll be talking to soloist Colin Curry about that new work a little later on. But first, Yannick Nézet-Séguin and I talk Bruckner, with particular reference to last season's tremendous performance of the Seventh Symphony and the forthcoming Eighth. First season as principal guest conductor of the LPO. What changes are you already noticing in the working relationship with the orchestra?
Maybe the most, not dramatic, but most obvious change is normal, is the fact that in certain pieces of the repertoire or areas of the repertoire, which is namely the German Romantic repertoire, I feel that the orchestra now already knows that I can lead to something. It's as if when we are at the starting point, it's not that there's no surprises. Of course, there are some surprises both ways. And I can talk to you more in detail about those this year. But at least we know where we're going. We know that the concert will be a certain kind. And I thought that the orchestra accepted me in that family of the company of the great maestri who have been doing some Bruckner and Brahms or Dvorak in the history of the orchestra. So that's obviously something which makes the work even more to the point right from the start of the rehearsals. So
yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, one of the big surprises for me, and I'm wondering if it's one of your big surprises, was the Bruckner 7, which I thought was remarkable in all sorts of ways, and I've heard a few in my time. It seems to me the biggest problem with Bruckner, and I don't know whether you agree, is to maintain the mobility of the music, that it can so often get bogged down in this monumental feeling that you have with it, which is important too, but that phrasing, that through movement of the music.
Yes, definitely a sense of line is the biggest challenge. But why is it the biggest challenge? Is because you cannot substitute the sense of line with the easy solution, which is to move forward. This music doesn't accept, in my world, to move forward the same way as you would, even in Brahms sometimes, or as you would in Beethoven, or as you would even in Mahler, or Wagner sometimes. This music has to accept to breathe. So then, that's the problem, and that's where the real challenge is that you need to find a way of sustaining that line and moving forward musically without actually doing it by the tempo. Mm-hmm. And that is the real key to that music. And then the added challenge this year with the LPO was to do Bruckner in Royal Festival Hall, which has absolutely no resonance. It's actually quite a warm sound. I like it. It's a warm, clear sound. It's very true. But all those big chords where you would expect some kind of resonance are not there. So there's also an illusion with the way of releasing the chords, and we have been working on that with the strings and with the winds, and just like not such a sharp end of a chord. But I think this we approached that last year as well. How, and this is coming from Giulini, how to love the octaves and the fifths and everything which for a musician da di da da di da da di da, and it can end up sounding so square, and say, well, okay, it must be a filling accompaniment. And then when you treat them as real motivic, but a theme, a melodic, even lyrical motif, then it takes another sense. And that's what's great about with the LPO. I didn't have to really talk about that. I could feel that already that kind of approach was there. Is the one I've conducted the most, actually, in my life so far, and it's arguably the one I love the most, just because to me it is the last finished product or masterpiece of Bruckner. The last movement, especially, is so wonderful and so well structured and so intense emotionally, with that release at the end of those bells in C major. I've always the impression that all the bells of all the churches in the world are at the same time ringing, and you do have that feeling of absolute conclusion of something. So as the ninth is very special because of its unfinished aspect, and seven is great, but seven, the first two movements are leading to somewhere that third and fourth, whilst being wonderful, are not as significant maybe as the third and fourth movement in number eight are the most significant of the symphony. So you're reversing then the structure. And I'm wondering if Bruckner was really aware of this. Probably he was, or somehow he was. And it does create a challenge that also the religious aspect, maybe spiritual aspect, is not as important. There is a celestial aspect in those harps and chords of the strings in the third movement, but other than this, my approach has a little bit more, do you say, pugnacious war aspect to it.
Well, he was a very earthy character. Completely. In many ways. I mean, he wasn't a saint.
No, himself not.
He was an outdoor man. You know?
And he was even describing his own scherzo in the number eight as the laughter of the joy of the of life on earth, and which somehow I get more and more now in the feeling of, and I'm so much looking forward, not only because it's Bruckner 8, not only because is Bruckner, not only because I love doing this with the LPO, but also because by creating those lines from one season to the other is also the way to develop a relationship, and also for the audience, I believe, people who've been there the seventh, just to expect, okay, so then where are we going with that team, Yannick and the LPO, with that same composer, and I will very much think of our seventh to approach the eighth.
Right. The coupling is fascinating.
Yes.
Rastavara. A new piece, Incantations,
yes,
with Colin Curry, who, as an ex-percussionist, I'm a great fan of.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Have you seen the score yet?
Yes, I've seen the score very recently, so unfortunately quite superficially now.
Yeah.
What I love about that composer, Rota Vara, is, and what I liked about Pudding with Bruckner, is that he is a composer, like many Scandinavian composers, he is a composer of greater landscapes. There is, it's not minimalistic, but yet you have a feeling of something organic, always a search for a center, I feel, in the body and in the music, rhythmically, and as well as in terms of the motifs which are there. Now, you put a percussion concerto there, so that's the great challenge. I felt that the orchestra is quite busy, actually, with the percussion so far, and it won't be a peaceful work, really, and you can't expect that, really, with percussion, if you want to explore the whole range of Colin and his talent. So, but in a way, it's great, because these... we were talking about the big structure of Bruckner, and definitely the writing is so different, but yet that common aspect of organic. I mean, I hope you won't laugh when I will say, tell you that my cats at home, when they listen to Bruckner, I feel that they're calm. I mean, there's something, but we're laughing, yes, I know, but still, what I mean is that there's something essential to that kind of music. It doesn't want to disturb the harmony of the earth, of the universe, and I feel the same with Rota Vara in general. Right. So that to combine this with a slightly more immediate rhythmic aspect with the percussion is quite exciting to me.
Finnish composer Rauta Vaara celebrated his 80th birthday last year and is still actively composing from his home in Helsinki. Since the late 1960s, his music has been rich, melodic and evocative, arcing back to Sibelius's Finnish landscapes through a distinctive and contemporary voice of his own. For percussionist Colin Currie, commissioning and performing new works is an important part of his musical life. In 2007, he performed Jennifer Higdon's percussion concerto with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, a performance that's now available on CD. And on the 24th of October, he is the soloist in the world premiere of Rauta Vaara's Incantations. I met up with him before his prom appearance this summer to find out more about the new work. What about Rauta Vaara's Incantations? This is the piece... you're performing with the LPO. I mean, he's a very, very iconic composer, and the line of succession back to Sibelius is pretty impressive, really. But
yeah, and very strong, and will be very audible in this piece, especially.
Mm. Tell us something about it. I mean, how much have you actually received the finished piece yet?
Oh, very much so. He was actually very lively in his reaction to this commission. Should share with you a lovely part of this story, which is that the idea was simply mooted, that he would write for me, and it was suggested that he would very much appreciate meeting me. And of course, he's quite elderly and doesn't really travel around so much, and so he's pretty much fixed there in Helsinki where he lives. So I arranged to go travel to Helsinki to meet him, and but this is well before the stage in the process came of finding orchestras to commission the work. So I turned up at his apartment, and he gave me a very warm welcome. He'd heard some of my recordings and just simply presented me with two completed movements.
Gosh.
Fully scored, everything. Sat down at the piano and played them for me. So I was, I was in shock. I mean, you know, it was very kind man, and just sort of very generous with his music. And he'd written these two movements out of confidence and sort of a generosity. And then the commissioning bodies came thick and fast, and we have four orchestras to commission the piece, including the London Philharmonic, of course, who get the premiere. And he's just been a beautiful person to work with, and he needed some assistance. He has not great experience with writing for percussion. He's always had quite limited approach with percussion within his ensemble pieces, for example. So we needed to change a few things around, and he's taken some advice again from me. And further than that, he actually asked me if I would write the solo cadenza myself in its entirety, which I have done, and found nerve-wracking as well as enjoyable, but it is finished.
Because you need to. I mean, what's the mix of skins and metal in the piece? And as far as the cadenza was concerned, I mean, presumably you have to kind of put on his kind of composerly vestments.
I have to wear his shoes.
Yes.
Well, the mix of percussion, he's gone for a very kind of resonant set of tuned percussion, mostly vibraphone, tubular bells, crotales, so everything very resonant, as well as the 5-octave marimba, which he's used absolutely fantastically. He's written a great marimba part, and as far as I know, he's not really so au fait with that kind of thing, and he's just used the instrument very well. He covers the range very well, because that's one thing that can sustain the interest nicely on that instrument, is really covering the range of the register available. So he's done that very well. So it's mostly on the tuned instruments. He has some untuned instruments to punctuate some of the rhythmic music, but he's stuck by and large to the resonant instruments to allow for a kind of sonority that suits this music. It's very rich, warm, quite dense harmonies, so a lot of chords with thick kind of sound, cluster chords.
That's his speciality, isn't it? I mean, what's the rest of the instrumental ensemble? I mean,
Very standard symphony orchestra. Mm-hmm. In fact, there are many things about the piece which are sort of standard. This piece is one that looks back as well as forward. It's a conventional romantic concerto. The first movement has orchestral introduction, the soloist is presented, the action kicks off, and we have a beautiful coda in that movement which recapitulates at the end of the third movement to finish the piece off. The second movement is a slow movement. The third movement is full of fireworks and features a solo cadenza. So it really is, it's your classic, classical concerto. And that's one of the reasons I went to him, is because I wanted to play, I wanted to have a kind of a romantic, if you like, piece, but not written in the sort of old-fashioned style, but something that would have bite as well as charm.
And it's going to be an interesting coupling, because it's Bruckner's Eighth Symphony. I mean, when I heard there was a percussion concerto in the first half, I thought, well, that's either very bold or very stupid. I wasn't quite sure, but it does sound, with its classical roots, as though it might work rather well.
I believe it will. And the piece is so sort of reflective. It really does hark back to Sibelius. Some of the chords and the progressions really do remind one of a kind of slightly modernized and slightly obscure Sibelius. So I think it will work very well with Bruckner.
It is such a specific landscape, isn't it?
Very
Sibelian landscape and Rautabarian landscape.
Yeah, the Nordic and expansive and mysterious.
To what extent are you aware of the theatricality of your instruments? Because, I mean, of all the families of the orchestra, percussion is the most theatrical. And indeed, there are many pieces in the repertoire that presumably you play which involve theatrical moments.
Yeah, I think I'm less aware of them than some people. I certainly don't like to accentuate them unless it's specifically called for, if there's some kind of literally theatrical, rather than the theatricality being as some kind of aside, because a great deal of motion is required to create the correct kind of sounds, especially if it's loud. You do need to move in a certain way that inevitably is interesting, and the calisthenics of it, the athleticism is something that the audience can latch onto, and our sounds are best heard live. I think the live experience of percussion is fascinating, and the audience turns up and there's kind of a set, if you like a theatre set in front of them, of these instruments, and one can look at the stage and sort of speculate as to what certain things are going to sound like. And there's a sort of frisson and excitement of turning up at a percussion concert and seeing all these wonderful instruments laid out, and the excitement of seeing how they will be exposed sonically.
Well, where do you put it?
Well, it's all at home. I mean, I have two rooms that are percussion rooms. One is more of a storeroom than anything, and the other one is where I have my setup.
So there's something, it's a permanent setup there that you
work
and practice on?
It's malleable, but basically there's a tuned percussion room where the marimba and a vibraphone are always there. Introduced to that might be other instruments, like in the Ratavara, when I have to place many other instruments around the marimba and vibraphone to create a sort of new rig. And that's one of the things that people forget. It's hard. Every percussion piece I play has a different setup. So it's not exaggeration to say I have to learn, you can almost say almost a new instrument every time, if you can describe the instrument as being a collection of sounds that you unify and make sure are homogenous for that performance. Mm-hmm. So you may have a piece that requires the marimba, log drum, pedal cowbell, bongos, three cymbals, and you have to play them all in such a way where they create phrases that make sense. And it really is like learning a new language every time you come to play a piece.
From the archive. Nick Tchaikov was the London Philharmonic Orchestra's second clarinet in the mid-1940s. He's recently written a book entitled The Music Goes Round and Around, about the music profession in London over the course of his long playing and administrative career. Here he speaks to John Talansky about Sir Adrian Bolt's dedication to new music, very much in evidence in the recent release on the LPO label of Sir Adrian conducting John Ireland's 70th birthday concert in 1949.
Now, can we just say a few things about Sir Adrian? Because he, of course, became the London Philharmonic Orchestra's principal conductor after you'd left.
Well, what he did for contemporary music in his own time was quite remarkable.
Yes.
The things that he did with the BBC Symphony Orchestra in particular. No, he wasn't popular musically, I would say, with the orchestra, because his beat was so vague. And my father, who was in the BBC Symphony Orchestra from when it started, told me how there were times when they had no idea just what he was doing. I mean, he was waving the stick around, and they just hoped for the best. But nonetheless, he got some very fine performances. I thought particularly, a work that he did particularly well again was Schubert 9.
That was one of many works that he had a very natural feeling for. Certain composers, actually, Schubert, Brahms,
yes.
Tchaikovsky. He was a very cultivated one.
Yes, and also we forget, and it's difficult to imagine him doing it, but he did The Rite of Spring. And he did that with the BBC Symphony Orchestra for concert. And I think it was only, it wasn't all that long after the debacle when it was first done for the ballet.
No, he did it in the 30s.
I think very early on.
Early on in the BBC's time.
Yes.
As, of course, he did, as you know, Wozzeck, a concert performance, which yes. the composer thought very highly of, Berg thought very highly of.
Yes, he's a very much underrated conductor.
October's release from the LPO label is a real curiosity from the earliest days of the orchestra's history. In 1934, the orchestra recorded Mozart's Jupiter Symphony at Abbey Road Studios, conducted by its founder, Sir Thomas Beecham. At the same time as this much-celebrated mono recording was being made, a team of technicians led by Alan Blumlein were simultaneously recording some portions in a new experimental format called binaural, later to be known as stereophonic. It's amazing to think that by 1933, Blumlein had already registered a patent containing all the principles still in use today for stereo recordings. Also on this disc are recordings of Mozart, Delius and Rimsky-Korsakov made in 1936 on tour in Germany, which in itself must have been an amazing journey, using the revolutionary new tape process to capture sound. To end this podcast then, I'm including an excerpt from the Stereo Test Mozart recordings, followed by an extraordinary track demonstrating the power of stereophony.
Coming over again on 4 by 0. Coming over. Now fully over on B.